This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Hello, and welcome to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Today is Earth Day, 4/22/2013, and in honor of that, we will be joined by Will Potter tonight by phone from Washington, D.C. Will is an award-winning independent journalist and author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. His book and website at greenisthenewred.com is about how animal rights and environmental activists are being targeted as eco-terrorists and what that means to our freedom and security. He will be speaking with us about that movement and how it is impacted by the justice system in these United States. Will, could you take a second to introduce yourself for us and the audience?
Sure. Like you said, I'm a reporter based in Washington, D.C., and I focus on civil liberties issues post 9/11. And I have a special area I focus on how terrorism rhetoric and legislation is being used against social movements, especially the animal rights and environmental movements, who have been labeled the number one domestic terrorism threat, according to the FBI. So I write a lot about the emergence of this idea of eco-terrorism and what this means for our First Amendment rights, not just for these movements, but for others as well.
So in this day and age, those are some pretty heavy accusations to be thrown around by the FBI. Tell us a little bit more about number one domestic threat.
It's a statement that we hear quite a bit, but there's no official listing of domestic terrorism threats by the FBI. They use statements like that to really emphasize the priorities and to shift the rhetoric of how these issues are discussed. You know, the animal rights and environmental movements, like every social justice movement, have a variety of elements. I mean, there are people who are leafleting and writing letters. There are people who are lobbying members of Congress. Others who are engaged in protests and civil disobedience. And of course, there are people who have broken the law, like the Animal Liberation Front and Earth Liberation Front. But in the history of these movements, there's never been any injury to human beings. At the same time, though, there's a history of increasing bloodshed by right-wing groups that, in my reporting, I've shown are consistently absent and sometimes missing entirely from FBI reports and discussion of terrorism. I think this word is really being used politically because of people's ideologies.
And so why would the government focus politically more on the eco-terrorists, quote-unquote, and the animal rights people than these seemingly more dangerous right-wing parties?
I think it's a really complicated question, but I think the start of the answer is looking at money and the influence of corporations on all levels of politics. You know, in my work, I've seen the lobbying efforts by corporations, not just for new legislation, but meeting with FBI and Homeland Security, their involvement in crafting terrorism memos that kind of help institutionalize this idea of the threat. And really, it's all of these efforts tie back to the fact that these movements have been incredibly effective at threatening corporate profits. They've done so not just with protests and civil disobedience. They've done it through illegal underground action. They've done it through winning the hearts and minds of increasing numbers of the American public who care about environmental and animal protection issues. And I think all of those things really represent a threat to these business interests. And that's why we see the development of this eco-terrorism language really as these movements were growing most quickly in the early 1980s.
You said illegal underground movements. Tell us more about that.
Sure. So I think the most recognizable of those are groups like the Animal Liberation Front and Earth Liberation Front. And the way these groups operate is that there's no official membership or hierarchy. They're really decentralized movements. And anyone who adheres to the principles of these movements can consider themselves part of the Animal Liberation Front or Earth Liberation Front. And that includes things like inflicting economic damage on corporations that are harming animals or the environment, and destroying property, releasing animals from laboratories and fur farms and either into the wild or putting them in new homes. And it's important to note one of those principles for both of those underground and vesting groups is to not harm human beings. Over the last about 20 years, 25 years, between a wide range of tactics by these underground movements that, in some cases, really rattled the industry and cost millions of dollars in damage and certainly drawn the attention of law enforcement as well.
So what has been the involvement of the justice system in this whole matter?
I think there's really two levels to that. One is that as people have been arrested, who, by the way, are quite a small number of the types of activists that we're talking about, but as people are arrested, they're hit with the full weight of the criminal justice system. So, for instance, in some cases out in the Pacific Northwest, a terrorism enhancement penalty was applied to really push the limits of existing law to threaten activists with multiple life sentences.
A terrorism enhancement penalty? What is that exactly?
So this was a provision of the law that was instituted in the aftermath of the Oklahoma City bombings, and it's intended to allow judges to elevate sentences based on the terroristic nature of the offense. In most cases, the prosecutors have argued for such a terrorism enhancement in the case of people who have done things like sent anthrax through the mail or tried to murder human beings. This was the first time this type of provision was used against environmental activists or animal rights activists.
And you said it was up here in the Pacific Northwest?
That's right. A group of activists engaged in underground action by the Earth Liberation Front. And the terrorism enhancement was applied, and also, as we'll talk about, I'm sure, a little bit later, reclassifying them in the prison system as terrorists, which has a radical effect on how these people are treated in the prison industry.
Right. Actually, tell us a little bit more about that, a reclassification as a terrorist.
So what we've seen in these cases is that people who are labeled as terrorists in the courts, that label continues to follow them as they enter prison and even post-prison as well. One of the most dangerous ways that affects activists in prison is there's been the creation of two secretive prison units called communications management units. One of those is in Terre Haute, Indiana, and the other in Marion, Illinois. And these are not for people who are have violent histories. They're people, according to the government, who, quote, have inspirational significance. In other words, these, in my opinion, are clearly political prisons for political prisoners. They're people who have been very outspoken in their social movements, for instance, in environmental and animal rights movements, and they're being singled out for harsh penalties. You know, these CMUs, as they're called, they radically restrict prisoner communications with the outside world, in some cases to levels meeting or exceeding some of the most restrictive facilities in the country, like the secure housing units or the ADX Florence Supermax. And these are people without violent criminal histories for the most part.
So who else would share cells with these individuals at the communications?
Sure. So, I mean, it's important to note that these secretive prisons overwhelmingly house Muslim prisoners. You know, there's no official roster of who is imprisonment, but based on research and discussion with attorneys, it's clear that upwards of 80% of prisoners in the CMUs are Muslim. This is compared to less than 1% of general population in more standard prison units. Most of the people that are there who are Muslim are not the 9/11 hijackers. They're not the Zacharias Moussauis of the world. They're people like Dr. Rafil Dafir, who violated the economic sanctions on Iraq by sending medical supplies to the children there. I think that's really indicative of the nature of these facilities. There's currently lawsuits against them by the ACLU and by the Center for Constitutional Rights because they're patently discriminatory. They single people out because of their political beliefs and also because of their ethnicity and their religion.
Okay. So as we've been discussing, there's a lot of talk about terrorist and eco-terrorist and, scary words these days. That they hold a lot of weight. What do you want us to know about that sort of branding that's been attached to it?
I think the most important thing for us to remember is how powerful a word terrorism has become, especially, you know, in the decade after September 11th. We often don't give that the attention it deserves. When people are being labeled as terrorists before they even set foot in a courtroom, it automatically skews public opinion against them. And I would argue it makes it impossible for people to get a fair trial. Once they're in the legal system, it can lead to radically enhanced prison sentences. Once they're in prison, it can reclassify them and send them to special prison units for terrorists. And then after they're released, they're stigmatized with that label for the rest of their lives. I think most importantly, though, the danger of this language is it's having a chilling effect on people that are paying attention and seeing these things happening. I mean, there's a fear of being labeled a terrorist that is impinging on people's First Amendment rights to express themselves because they're afraid of being treated in the same way.
So do you think it's an unfair label?
Absolutely. I think the most important thing to remember about any usage of the word terrorism is that it's always used against people because of their political ideologies. There is no standard definition, even within law enforcement or within the U.S. government. It's a fluid term to be used against the enemy of the hour.
Okay, let's get into some specific examples. On your website, you talk a little bit about the Shack 7. Who are they and what do they stand for?
The Shack 7 were a group of activists who ran were part of an international campaign against a laboratory called Huntington Life Sciences. And HLS had been exposed multiple times through undercover investigations, showing workers punching beagle puppies in the face, dissecting while they were still alive, I mean, really horrific animal abuses. And this was a contract testing company that was dealing with corporations around the world. So Stop Hunting in Animal Cruelty emerged as an international campaign with the sole purpose of shutting this laboratory down. And they were incredibly effective at doing that. They brought this multinational corporation near bankruptcy many times. This is a campaign based on things like protests and letter writing, phone calls, civil disobedience. And also on their website, Shack US had information about illegal things that had happened in the name of the same campaign. Things like broken windows or animals stolen from laboratories. All of it went up on the website. And Shack was very clear of saying that they didn't do any of these things, but they supported ideologically the spirit in which it was done. And the case against them is really troubling because it was based on conspiracy. So the government didn't argue that these activists had done anything to break the law. The government argued they were part of a conspiracy because they ran a website in which they supported the ideology and the beliefs and the, you know, rhetorically they spoke in favor of things like this. And they were convicted of animal enterprise terrorism, conspiracy to commit animal enterprise terrorism, conspiracy to stalk, and conspiracy conspiracy to harass using not telecommunications devices, which is because they encourage people to take part in electronic civil disobedience. And for that, they were sentenced to between 1 and 6 years in prison.
And so the publication of these illegal events that were taking place, could that not be construed as encouraging illegal activities?
Sure. I mean, absolutely, people have a right to encourage illegal activities if that's something that they believe in. You have a right to write about why you think people should break the law and use civil disobedience. I have the right to be on this radio show and talk about, breaking the law in a principled way if that's something I feel very strongly about. What's important to note, though, is that we have very strong First Amendment protections at which you have the right to make such statements until they begin to incite imminent and lawless action. I mean, that's really the First Amendment standard. And what's dangerous about the Shack 7 ruling is that this is the first time that imminent and lawless action has been construed to mean words printed and actions and distributed on the Internet. So in other words, we all hear this phrase of, you can't shout fire in a crowded theater, or the famous case of Brandenburg v. Ohio, which, you can't get a mob of people to go commit illegal acts that you're inciting them to do at that moment. But that's not what we were talking about here. The Shack 7 case was about putting things up on the Internet. If anyone acted based on that information, it was weeks or months later, and the government didn't show that there was any incitement whatsoever, and these people were still convicted.
That's a scary thought. A scary thought for a lot of people who post things on the Internet, I think.
And I think that's a really important element of this. I mean, we have to recognize how the nature of communications has changed so much and how heavily dependent we all are on online communication. And for the government to argue that something posted online can be construed as imminent and lawless and not having First Amendment protection, I think, is really dangerous.
So you mentioned earlier the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Tell us a little more about that.
This law was passed in 2006 at the lobbying of corporations like Pfizer and Wyeth, GlaxoSmithKline, and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. And it expands the law that was used to convict the Shack 7. So this previous law was already overly broad and already sending people to prison based on their web postings. This new law goes even further, and it wraps up a wide range of activity as animal enterprise terrorism. And if it infects the loss of profits of the corporations that are targeted. And when I testified against this legislation before the House Judiciary Committee, supporters of the law even acknowledged and it can be used to go after nonviolent civil disobedience as terrorism.
The law in it outlines the loss of profit as something that's illegal to cause for corporations.
That's really a central point of the legislation. And there's been, for instance, when I testified, there's some debate about how this should be read. And then recent court cases, there has been further discussion about this, but I mean, the central point of the legislation is to criminalize those who affect a loss of profits of corporations. Now, the law attempts to parse out some conduct. For instance, anyone who physically damages or disrupts animal enterprises, which there are things that are already illegal, like, breaking windows and stealing animals, underground actions by the Animal Liberation Front. But I think the real danger of the legislation is that it begins to wrap up other activities, such as undercover investigations by animal rights groups. And according to FBI files that I've obtained, the FBI considered prosecuting undercover investigators as terrorists as far back as 2003.
So, Will Potter, independent journalist, award-winning journalist who writes about violations of civil liberties, and especially with regards to the environmental movement and animal rights movement. Why don't you tell us a little bit about some of what's going on right now in the animal and eco rights movements?
Sure. I think one of the most important things for everyone to know about are the rise of what are called ag gag laws, which are laws introduced at the state level specifically targeting undercover investigation by animal protection groups, animal welfare abuses on factory farms and slaughterhouses. And these bills are specifically in retaliation for the effective expose. So groups like the Humane Society, Mercy for Animals, and Compassion Over Killing have exposed animal welfare abuses on these factory farms and slaughterhouses that have led to the largest meat recall in U.S. history. They've led to criminal charges in multiple states. They've led to just a radical change in public dialogue about these issues. And these bills are an attempt to not address the cruelty and the workers' rights violations and the food safety violations, but an attempt to just stop the video footage from coming out, to stop the whistleblowers. And that's why groups like the ACLU, the Teamsters, AFL-CIO, Government Accountability Project, ASPCA, and countless others are opposing these attacks on whistleblowers, on workers, on journalists, and of course on the animals. What's also important to know about these bills is that they're not just limited to factory farms and slaughterhouses. The new bill that was introduced in North Carolina includes all of manufacturing. That's every industry. Similarly, the bill in Indiana is written so broad that it includes mining, timber, and gas operations. I mean, this is specifically including people who document fracking and the environmental consequences of that. And these are laws that really affect all movements, regardless of how you feel about animal protection issues or workers' rights or the environment, journalism, free speech. This affects everybody. Now, of course, there will be selective prosecution, because the intent of this legislation is to go after people who are exposing these abuses with a political motivation. So, you know, the likelihood of someone being prosecuted for their research or, you know, a graduate program or something like that, I think is quite low, but the likelihood of someone doing the exact same thing for the purpose of an environmental campaign or a union campaign is quite high.
The Center for Constitutional Rights on the 17th of April appealed the dismissal by a federal judge of a lawsuit that was challenging the constitutionality of the AETA. That's the American Enterprise Terrorism Act. So what's your take on that?
Well, the recent ruling by the district court about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act lawsuit was quite disappointing, but it was also, in some ways, a good thing. And here's how. I mean, this lawsuit was arguing that the First Amendment rights of animal rights activists were being chilled because it was making them afraid to speak up lest they be labeled as terrorists under the law. Now, what the court ruled, what the judge ruled, is that all the activity that they want to be engaged in, like protests, leafleting, speaking out, doing media, things like this, none of those things are would fall under the purview of the legislation. So that's a great development, because in some ways there had been no ruling of that type that explains the judge's perspective, and also it has the government on record as well. However, one, that ruling isn't binding in any way, and the second thing is that it also doesn't address the fundamental issues of the entire reach of this legislation. For instance, with people that might break the law by trespassing to film what happens on a factory farm or to use nonviolent civil disobedience, those still involve minor law breaking, and they should not be labeled as terrorism. They could still be wrapped up under this legislation. So I think there's a lot of issues that still need to be addressed, and that's why the Center for Constitutional Rights is appealing the decision to get more clarity and also to provide some checks and balances on this very broad legislation.
You know, why should your average Joe care about this at this point in time?
That's a good question. I think, you know, this really, the issues we're talking about today affect everyone, no matter what you feel about animal rights or environmental activists, or even if you're not an activist yourself, I would argue that doesn't matter at all. What we're talking about is how people are being singled out because of their political beliefs and hit with disproportionate sentences. They're the subject of new legislation, new terrorism laws being specifically written about activists because of their politics and how effective they are. New state laws, new secretive prison units. I mean, all of this, I think, really cuts to the heart of core notions about what it means to live in a democracy, what it means to live in a country that is singling people out because of their political ideology. And I think this, you know, the reason I've devoted so much of my work to these issues is not just because of the animal rights and environmental movements, but because if there's one thing we've seen throughout U.S. history is that these tactics never stop there. They expand to other movements as well. They set a very dangerous precedent about how First Amendment and due process rights can be rolled back in the name of fighting terrorism. If people would like to learn more about these issues, you can visit my website, which is greenisthenewred.com. And I've been writing and publishing interviews and similar materials on that site for many years, and there's plenty of background information. And you can also check out my book, which is Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege, which was published by City Lights Books out of San Francisco.
Great. Thank you very much, Will Potter. Again, Will Potter is joining us for Earth Day. Will is an award-winning independent journalist and author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. His book and his website, greenisthenewred.com, are about how animal rights and environmental activists are being targeted as eco-terrorists and what that means to our freedom and safety. Thank you very much for listening tonight. Listen to this and past Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you very much again to Will, our engineer Danielle, to KBOO, and to our audience.
Hey, everybody, it's about 7 o'clock. Well, it's 7:01 in the evening, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. And KBOO will resume normal scheduled programming tomorrow morning after this word from our sponsor. Thank you.
Thank you.